You remind me of, I was thinking about this the other day. I read this story, and I was like, as I was like trying to prepare for you to come in, there was this 2,000-year-old vase at a museum. You're not 2,000 years
Cool.
old, but there's this 2,000-year-old vase at a museum, and what they ended up, it was on display for years, and people would come and admire it and be like, oh my gosh, this is like 2,000, that's a long time. Like the
Yeah.
United States is only what, almost 250 years old, or
Yeah.
just about. And they found it was a cheap knockoff. And I
Oh.
immediately thought of you
Oh, that's fair. That's fair. That's fair.
as that
Absolutely.
person.
Yeah.
All right, so hey, Sergeant Major Walsh, First Engineer, Battalion, Command Sergeant Major. So what we like to do here on this podcast is really get to know you. Everybody always asks, like, oh, what are we going to talk about? I always say we're talking about you because we want to get to know you. And as you know, our goal here is to actually get to know our soldiers, right? But also part of this is to bridge generational gaps, right? So like understanding where you came from and where you're at today, which is a journey. I do know you, for like full disclosure. I know Sergeant Major Walsh a little bit and know a little bit about his story. We joke about it quite often. But then to also hear from soldiers and where they're at and where they became, and to kind of see where they're going to go in the future. So without that long intro. How's it going? How are you feeling?
Good, great. I'm happy
Good.
to be here.
That's awesome.
I think it's important, and even when I talk to my soldiers, a lot of people think that Sergeant Major Walsh just showed up and he was a Sergeant Major,
Yeah.
and they don't understand all of the poor decisions that I've made throughout my life and all of the things that have gotten me to this point. And my story, after I've told it numerous, numerous times, isn't that much different. Yes, or the details are different,
Right.
obviously. But it's not that much different than a lot of the junior soldiers that we have that are struggling right now.
So you brought up poor decisions. What are you don't have to start in any sort of order or whatever, but what are some of the ones that you look back on and you're like, wow, I can't believe I'm here. I mean, I even have a few of those that are like, oh, but they're after listening to you talk about it, I'm good. Like I'm a good kid.
Yeah. I like I said, I see people come in and they're in trouble and they try to tell me that they made a mistake. And I've told everybody from the very beginning that usually they aren't mistakes.
Yeah.
They were poor decisions. You knew exactly what you were doing and you just got caught doing it. And I think that's what I've learned throughout my career, not just my career, but my life, is that I did make a lot of really poor decisions. In the Army, out of the Army. Like we've talked about before, I had a 4-year break in service, made a lot of really poor decisions. I mean, I guess I can just start
Go ahead. Yeah,
from
dig
back
in, man. We're
then.
here. Yeah.
I mean, if you want to go all the way back,
It's hey, as far as back as you want to.
it's up to you. So,
Then let's go all the way back
all the way back.
to
So I was born July 9th, 1980.
First
And
mistake.
yeah, that was the first mistake. That was a poor decision on other people's part. My mom turned 17 on July 4th, 1980, so 5 days before I was born. And my father was a heroin addict, and they lied on my birth certificate, actually, because we lived in a van in Southern California. So fast forward,
So the address they put down was the house that the van was parked outside.
probably. Yeah, absolutely. So fast forward, I didn't know anything about that. I didn't know anything about him. Fast forward, had a fairly normal childhood, I guess you could say. I was terrified of everything. I was scared to swim. I was scared to ride a bike. I was scared of heights. I was scared of getting shots at school. I was scared of everything.
Why?
I don't really know. I don't remember a large portion of my childhood, which probably some
It's
type of
fair.
trauma
Nah.
in some sort. Man, I think I wet the bed until I was in sixth grade. Yeah, so lots of childhood trauma that I don't really remember, as it's just completely blocked out.
Except for the worst stuff.
Yeah. So then I graduated high school in 98, and then January 4th of 99, I joined the Army. I went to 82nd Engineer Battalion, that's actually here at Fort Riley, but it was in Bamberg, Germany at the time. We deployed to Kosovo. That was like the big thing back then.
Right. Yeah.
Like we were going to war. and it was not that
yeah,
was at all.
A little different. Fast forward a couple years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and then in January of 2002, I got out of the Army. And I had, showing up to Germany as an 18-year-old, drinking was just what we did.
Yeah.
Lots of poor decisions around drinking, and I could have obviously been a much better soldier. And then I got caught up in the whole, like, it's so much better in the real world and all these things that I listened to. And I even tell soldiers when they show up at the Victory Reception Center that they're going to meet this one person. It could be a male or female, it doesn't matter. But they're going to meet, and it's always for the junior soldiers. They're just coming from AIT. They're going to meet this person, and it's that senior specialist.
Mm.
The one that is disgruntled with the Army, that says they got screwed somehow.
Yeah.
And they're going to tell you how terrible Fort Riley is, how terrible your unit is. They're going to tell you all these things. And then they're going to tell you about this wonderful other place, and it's called their last unit. And their last unit is always the best place on the planet. I've never been to the last unit,
yeah.
But it is amazing, right? Yeah. But they were complaining about that place while they were there.
I should tell you this. Like, I usually wait. I'm usually in the shadows, and I wait for you to tell your soldiers that, and then I'm actually that person.
Oh,
like,
you?
He does not know what he's talking about.
This place is actually terrible.
This is the worst place ever.
Yeah, so I got caught up in that, and that was back in the Army when you had ACAP, and you could basically just waive everything. So I just waived it all because I lied to everybody in like my personal life, my parents and everybody else, and told them I was going to college just so they'd get off my back because I didn't have a plan.
Yeah.
I was still just coming back home to live on the couch. I did go to college for a little while, partied too much.
No way. That's wild.
Yeah. And then in 2003, I had a DUI. So that was one of my real, real poor decisions. But that didn't stop me from drinking or continuing to party and do the things that I was doing. So then in 2006, I decided to join the Army again. So I came back in at, I was almost 25 years old. I was a E2. And I showed back up to, they asked me where I wanted to go. I still had to be a combat engineer. They asked me where I wanted to go. I said I wanted to go back to Germany. They sent me to Italy on accident for a little bit. And then ended up back in Bamberg, Germany.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Yeah. But.
Well, hey, if you don't mind. So you just re-entered the Army. But why? I mean, so you're going through, obviously you're going through it. If I can sum up what you're going through. And so then you decide just willy-nilly, like it's 2006, you know, everyone looks like they're having fun in the military, or what kind of like mindset are you in at that point to just kind of be like, all right, I think I made a mistake or whatever it is that you decided, and then I'm gonna come back in the military?
I think both times that I joined the Army, I was running. You know, I was running from my poor decisions. I was running from all of the things that my friends were doing. And I think that that's kind of the point that a lot of people miss, especially with our junior soldiers, the enlisted soldiers, is a lot of them didn't join the Army because they had a great life. They probably didn't have a lot of other options, and that's why they're here. And I think that's why it's important to share your story and share the struggles that you've had, because when real life happens to them, they know that you've been through it, that you're not just sitting on your throne saying these things to these soldiers. So I was running again, and I liked the military. And it was a form of structure for me, structure that I couldn't find in the real world. I worked construction. I worked at a movie theater for a while. I worked at a window and awning company. Like I said, I went to college for a little while.
You pick jobs. The grass is truly greener.
Yeah.
At all of those places.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, like I said, in 2006, when I came back in the Army, that was when I decided that I was just going to stay in the Army until they said, we don't need you anymore. And once I changed that mentality, it made all of the little things that bothered me previously not bother me at all.
Right.
Because I just knew I was going to be it for the long haul. And I actually heard, I think it might have been the CG when he was talking about compliance versus commitment. And he talked about once you change your mindset to being committed to the military, then it makes it a lot easier. And that's kind of when it clicked for me. It's like, yeah, it absolutely did in 2006 when I was like, you know what, this is going
to
be it.
Which I don't think is like a hard thing to ask. Like, I feel, correct me if I'm wrong, please do. Actually, I know you will. I don't need to say that. Where I feel like we're trying to like convince soldiers that you have to, you know, like we're almost convincing them you have to be committed. You have to like decide that the Army is for you, regardless if it's short term or long term. And it's almost like we're convincing them to do something that other organizations aren't doing as well. You know, if you go work for whoever you're going to, they want you to be committed to the success of that business. But for some reason, you do it in the Army, and it's like we're doing this weird faux pas thing that like, well, you know, we just gotta let soldiers kind of like get there themselves. It's like, nah, man, we need them to be all in on what they're doing. We're not telling them they have to be all in forever, and there's like now their life is this only if that's not what they want. We just need it for whatever time that they're with us, we need it.
Absolutely. And I talk to all of our soldiers that are either going to ETS out of the military or they're potentially being chaptered or whoever it is. And I ask them those same things. Hey, you know, do you think that when you get out of the military, you're going to go to whatever job you're going to go to and there's not going to be things that you don't like about it? And they're like, well, no. And I was like, okay, so what's the difference? Like, at what point are you going to, honestly, it's growing up, it's maturing, and it took me a long time to do that.
Mm-hmm. Still do it.
Absolutely. So I think that kind of helps them realize that, you know, they're going to have to make that transition to commit to something.
Yeah.
And it might not be the military, and the military isn't for everybody, but at least understanding that it is going to take a commitment, that it's not a job. That even if you're in it for a short period of time, it is still a career.
Yeah. Okay. So 2006, you're in the Army, you ran away. Luckily, you're back in the organization where running is a thing.
Yeah.
So you just kind of keep going with that. Where you, okay, 2006 and going on. Like, what's,
so then I hit the ground sprinting, and I told myself I was going to do everything I could. Every school I could get my hands on, I deployed 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, all with 173rd. Saw a bunch of not great things. And while I was on R&R leave on my second deployment, I got DA selected to be a drill sergeant, which is not taking a knee. And then straight from a drill sergeant to being a platoon sergeant here in 1st Engineer Battalion. And then I got my first somewhat break. I worked at HRC for a year and then directly into a first sergeant position. And then I went to the NCO Academy. And that was the first time, that was 2018, I believe. That was the first time from when I had joined the Army again to when, to that point in my life that I had any time to slow down. And it was July 14th of 2020, and I had, my drinking was completely out of control.
Through this whole time, I'm not trying to like say,
no, I mean, it was off and on. And it was never an issue for me of drinking every day. But when I did, it was all of it.
Yeah.
I mean, and I knew I am not going to drink hard alcohol because that was just bad. And even now talking about it, thinking, man, like you knew that you couldn't drink hard alcohol. So you knew there was a problem.
Right.
You were just going to like,
just cover it with Mick Ultra.
Yes. So, My family had left. They were up in Kansas City. I was at Fort Leonard with the NCO Academy, a first sergeant of Engineer SLC. And my family had left, and I had blacked out. And I came out of a blackout at 40 years old on a three-way call with my mom and my wife. And that was like the end of everything. Like everything had come to a head. All of the time that I had not dealt with any of the things that I saw in Afghanistan, any of the trauma throughout my entire life, anything, everything kind of seemed to just come crashing back because I slowed down, because I stopped being so busy. It all came back. So that was the last time that I had a drink, and it's even strange looking back, like I was a first sergeant. And I was like, man, I need to go get help. And so I went to ASAP. And they were like, you're an idiot. we don't do that here. You need to go to Sudsea. They didn't say you're an idiot. But I went to the wrong place. And I was like, I was a first sergeant. I should know where to go if you need to get help. So I went to Sudsea. I self-enrolled. And then I started going to behavioral health as well. Did a lot of different types of therapy, written exposure, prolonged exposure. Another one called eye movement desensitization reprogramming. A bunch of different things throughout behavioral health. And there is still, as much as we want to say there's not, there's still a stigma with seeking help, specifically for senior leaders. But for anybody going to behavioral health or going to get help with your drinking or any help you need, there's still a stigma. And even when I was going to behavioral health, people told me, hey, you know, you can go in civilian clothes. And I was like, why would I do that? And they said, so that way, because you're a first sergeant and, you know, what if soldiers see you? I want them to see me walking into this place because I'm not immune. Nobody in this room is immune. Nobody is above needing help and going and seeking it.
So I'm sorry. I feel like I just cut you off there.
No, you're good.
I'm okay. Cause that takes a lot to do.
Yeah.
And I know and I must apologize if people think I'm laughing at your laughing.
Oh
at
no.
Pain. Like, we've joked a lot about a lot of this. And I think we both found out that that's our coping mechanism for almost 100%. Anything. Even when talking about my minuscule problems that I thought I went through as a good kid, is laughing through that pain. So, but where do you, I think this is maybe a harsh question. And so it may come off as a little much, but you obviously, and it took you a while. So I'm not saying like it happens, like you should just be able to do this, but maybe to help some soldiers that are there and their struggles, not your struggles, but their struggles are just dealing with, you know, a tough leader that they've never dealt with. And the leader's great and fine, but they're just tough and they think through. Like, where do you think like that discipline has to kick in to say like, you're like, why is it okay for you to be disciplined in this way? You know, like for you to be disciplined, to understand that you have a problem. But when you try to, I don't want to say preach, but when you try to teach that to others, like they just have this excuse for that. A discipline doesn't apply to them because it's hard. It's like harder for them than it was for you or whatever. And you don't know what it's like to go through that.
I know specifically with the sobriety piece. I found out that sobriety is a very, very selfish thing. That you're not going to do it. If you truly commit to it, you're not going to do it for anybody else.
Right.
Because throughout over 20 years of drinking, which is socially acceptable in our environment, I mean, I had my mom, I had my wife, I had every person tell me, hey, you need to slow down, you've got a problem. Not as much people at work, not people that I directly worked with, but other people in the military said that I had a problem. And it wasn't until I was ready and I realized that nobody else is going to make that change for me but me, that nobody's coming to save me, that nobody is, there's not some magic thing that's going to happen. And luckily it didn't take a tragic
right.
event.
Right.
A lot of people end up in that situation where they've gotten a DUI and killed somebody or something like that happens. And now this traumatic event happens and that's the catalyst for you to stop doing whatever stupid thing that you were doing.
Which is not the sexy story, right? Because it's just like, obviously you were blacked out. You didn't know what you were doing beforehand, but it's just like, hey, I just realized that I needed to do this. And I have a question about that here in a second too, but that's the tragedy, I think, of trying to convince soldiers that, yes, it sounds fun because you're 20 or you're in your 20s or lower 30s, and maybe you're with somebody, maybe you're not, you have no responsibilities outside of just yourself. So you're not hurting anybody, but it's really hard to convince them, like, just don't, like, you can go out and have fun, just don't make these bad decisions. Don't be the person that decides to never drink or drink and drive again or even put themselves in that situation because you hurt somebody and tragically. So I think that's a kind of a good point to make there. And so what pushed you through? Like, so obviously you're saying a lot, like obviously you went to a lot of behavioral health to help out. You went through the SUDC program and all that stuff. But like, what was kind of that internal mechanism that helped you and like get you pushed through to like understand that you could do this? And like just pure internal like hate and discipline of your past like decisions, or is there something else?
So at the very beginning, it was day to day. And sometimes it still is. I mean, there's still plenty of days that I still want to drink. But it was day to day. So I knew, I had told myself when I stopped drinking, I was going to run every single day for a year straight. So it was at least a 5K a day, every single day of the year, which I did. But in the beginning, when I really wanted to drink, I would tell myself if I could make it to a certain point in the day, then getting drunk and feeling like crap the next day wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
And then I started realizing that throughout my, you know, I don't know how long I had been in the Army at that point, probably 14 years or something like that, maybe 15 years, that every Monday was starting over because I would work. I couldn't wait till Friday. And I tell the soldiers this too, because I will tell you, I don't tell people that drinking is bad because I don't think alcohol is bad. I think it's bad for me.
Yeah.
And if you can do it and you can be responsible and you can make the right choices, then absolutely have fun and do whatever you're going to do. It's just not okay for me. And so I realized that every Monday I was usually hungover because I had partied Friday and Saturday.
Makes sense.
Nursed it on Sunday. And then Monday would show up and I felt like crap and I would just start the week over again. There was never any true progress in any type of physical stamina or muscular endurance or anything. It was just gritting, just true grit through, you know, those Monday morning runs of however far they were. And then once I stopped all that, I was like, wow, like I'm actually getting better. I'm actually getting faster.
Wow.
I'm healthier.
Surprise.
Yeah. All of these things that like we talk about and then you do it and you're like, oh my God, it actually works.
And now you're on the other side of that.
Yeah.
Telling people all these things that you can do to get better. And they're like, oh, it's not happening.
Yeah. And then, And then they still continue to make the poor decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you, let's see here. So when you're going through, so you've been through not only quite a bit, like personally, but like professionally as well, because you took a break, you know, did, you know, Lord knows what you did in those 4 years holistically, but you did, you know, you said you went to college, you did, worked a bunch of jobs. What was like a huge difference? Like, was the Army different for you, or were you just different when you kind of came back in, or just like from a mental perspective, or was the Army, did you notice a difference? Because I guess when you come back in 2006 from 1990...
So I got out in 02.
Yeah, so...
Yeah.
Okay, so 9/11 had happened.
Yep.
But not to the scale, you know, like, you know, there had been a lot of that had happened in between even 02 and 06, right? So do you feel like the Army changed, like, or was it kind of a good seamless transition back?
Oh, no, it was totally different. And the weird thing was is everybody kind of gave me the benefit of the doubt because they knew I was prior service. And
so you still knew things?
Yes, but the basic things, I remember walking around in the morning and somebody asked me, hey, where's your PT belt? And I said, oh, I'm good. And they're like, what are you talking about? You have to wear it. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then they told me to get in the turret of one of the vehicles. And they're like, where's your iPro and gloves? I'm like, I'm good. Like, what are you talking about? And they're like, you have to wear it. What are you even talking about? So like, things had changed in the military, but I just wasn't aware of how those things changed. And Bamberg, Germany, in 82nd Engineer Battalion from 99 to 02, you know, my platoon sergeant was a staff sergeant. And back then, you know, it was okay to, not that it's not okay now, but to be a staff sergeant and retire. That was not like completely out of the norm. My squad leader was a sergeant. We didn't have very many sergeant first class around. We didn't have any of those things. And then coming back in, the other thing that totally changed for me was I went from a heavy mechanized unit to coming back in the Army, and then I was in the airborne unit. My experience was that they were polar opposite. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the camaraderie. I enjoyed, I would say, a certain level of arrogance in that organization.
That checks.
Yeah. And I needed those things. I needed that type of leadership. I needed all of that because that's where I was in my life. Right. I was really hungry. Like I said, I wanted to go to every school I could get my hands on. I wanted to do everything I possibly could in the shortest amount of time possible. And then they made the mistake of sending this real arrogant paratrooper to go be a drill sergeant.
Why do you say that?
Because I think that some people let being a drill sergeant as well become their persona. For me, it was an act. It wasn't, I'm just this monster that was a drill sergeant back then. Which I would say was probably one of the most rewarding jobs that I had ever done. You don't think that in red phase when you haven't eaten and you still have to wear your hat everywhere and you don't have a voice and all of these things. But when you're at graduation, and it was never the moms crying because the moms are always going to cry. It was when a dad would cry. And a dad would come up to me and say, hey, have you seen Private Smith? And I'd be like, yeah, you just walked by him.
Yeah.
And he had lost 50 pounds or he looks like a different person or whatever it was. And you see the dad break down and cry. And those were the things that really made being a drill sergeant worth it.
So as you now command sergeant major, so like one that's obviously a big deal. It's a pinnacle moment. And almost it's probably the pinnacle moment, depending on how long you go after that in any enlisted soldier's career. You just said it. It's maybe something that Fort Riley and 1ID doesn't get because we're an armored heavy unit. And so culturally, you're either in it and you really love it or you don't. So how do you kind of bridge that to like what you experienced? And I'll say that, you know, the arrogance, your word, not mine. I would never say that about that unit ever. They're awesome. But how do you kind of bridge that to say like, hey, like they don't have to be the only unit that is like proud of their unit, proud of their heritage, proud of their history, proud of their former leaders, current leaders, to like say like, hey, we're, you know, like this is it. Like we're the best engineer battalion or we're the best battalion on this installation.
It's hard. And definitely a big difference was we were in Europe. And I mean, I was a senior staff sergeant when I left. I was still living in the barracks because that was just the rules.
Yeah.
And so we all worked together. Most of us lived together unless you were married. So it was different in that aspect. But I think that I've seen a lot of soldiers get hung up on like, oh, it's a heavy mechanized unit. It's not as sexy as these other type of units.
Right.
And I'm not going to get the opportunity to go to any of these schools, or I'm not going to get the opportunity to do any of these things. I will say that the only school that I've ever seen be denied at this installation was airborne school. And that's because we don't need paratroopers in a Bradley or in a tank.
Not yet.
Not yet. but other than that, I have not seen a single person be denied for something. But I tell new soldiers, like, it's not, hey, do you want to go to Sapper Leader Course or Ranger School or whatever the school is? And their response is, oh, well, I got to get ready. No, no, no. Like, it's just, you're just going to be ready.
Yeah.
Because the opportunity could come, and when you say, oh, I've got to get ready, it's going to the next person that is ready.
Right.
And then it's also not just celebrating the schools, because there's a lot of other things that soldiers are doing, and not everybody can physically do all of those things. Not everybody can go to airborne school or Pathfinder school or Sapper Leader Course or Ranger school or any of those other things, but they can go to college. They can succeed in other ways. They can join the Audie Murphy Club. They can do all sorts of other things that can still make them successful in the military outside of going to a badge or tab producing school.
What are some of the things you guys do? I know these are all like tangible things, obviously, but like let's count the schools as tangible things, but intangible things that like you don't see every day. What are some of those like intangible things that you guys do at your battalion to kind of like instill the competition or instill that will of like we're the best and we're always going to be the best? Like I'll put my battalion up against anybody else. What are those things you guys do to try to build a culture like that?
Well, I think it was just that warrior competition that just happened and 1st Engineer Battalion won it.
No big deal.
I think that the brigade needed somebody that was going to provide a team that would win.
The year
and they came to 1st Engineer Battalion.
Let me cut you off. So I was in 1st Brigade, and we did a lot of things with the engineer battalion is HHC Brigade's parent organization as far as for 05 and battalion. And when I was lining up the group so the CG and Sergeant Major can recognize them, I said, "What brigade are you guys from?" And they said, "First Brigade." And then one of them, like, I saw that one of them had a sapper tab on. So I said, "Oh, are you guys Alpha Company, First Eng?" And they go, "Yep."
You already knew.
I was like, "Oh my goodness, of course you guys were."
Yep, you already knew. But it's things like that. It's competing in Best Squad. Last year they won Best Squad for 1st Infantry Division. And they almost won for 3rd Corps. It starts every morning with PT and being present.
Right.
The Colonel and I both being present at PT, being present at profile PT. I'm there every single morning making sure that those people are there, because profile PT is not supposed to be something that's easy.
No.
I equate it. I asked all of them, "How many of you gone to physical therapy?" And a lot of them raised their hand. And I said, "How many of you think it sucks? And if it's good physical therapy, it sucks. Yeah. It's painful. It's not supposed to feel good."
Yeah.
Or something that where you're getting out of PT or something like that. So we're trying to change the culture around that as well. Of it's not just you're going to be on profile and that's the end of the story. It's that you're on profile, yes. And profile is not a bad word. Sometimes you're hurt and you need to get better. But the point is to get better.
So people like to say the Army's soft, right? Now, compared to, and obviously you were there pre 9/11, you came, and then you're there even a little bit after, but then you came back out or left and came back in, and you've been through kind of this. I don't know. I kind of just said, "Hey, the Army's soft," and I left it at that, and that's not what I mean. But I guess like people kind of complain, especially you know, let's pick on it, your generation of folks, and even to mine. I've been in the Army for at least 13 years. To say that it's a little softer than it was back in the day. Do you agree with that? Or do you just think, which is maybe kind of what I think, is that the holding people to a discipline and a standard has maybe shifted a little bit to where we try to make it easier? Because I guess culturally, like the larger culture of America is maybe a little bit more like that.
Yeah, I don't think that the Army itself or the military in general is softer.
Right.
I think that the leaders in the military have changed, rules and regulations have changed, and enforcing those, it takes, even for me now, after 22 years in the Army, it still takes personal courage to go and make a correction on somebody, to think about that interaction that I'm going to have with that person, and that I'm not going to come out there and scream at them or anything like that, because I've seen those things happen, and it goes sideways really fast.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to scream at you or tell you that you're jacked up or anything like that, but tell you that something that you're doing is wrong.
Okay, well then how do you convince sergeants who are, I mean, you just said, because again, same feeling, right? If I see something, I'll call myself out here. You just saw somebody that just walked by me and they didn't salute, which like to me, like as Logan Bridgeford, who cares? Like I don't, you know, but as officer of the military, I know there's standard and discipline and you're supposed to do this thing and you didn't do it. It's the easiest thing to do. Well, it's probably not the easy, but like there's other easy things, but it's an easy thing to just do. And of course I just walked by and I did not, and I just felt like an idiot because I did not be like, "Hey man, like there's just, you know what you're supposed to do. Just do it and just go on with your life. And we can even pretend like it didn't happen." So then how do you convince those sergeants or whatever that are brand new, they just passed the board, they know what that means now because they've been told, like, "Hey, when you pin these stripes on, you're now somebody different. You think that you're not, and you're still going to have your friends, but, like, you are somebody different now, and you need to uphold this discipline and the standard 10% higher than you did, you know, that now than you were supposed to before." You know, how do we convince them that, hey, it's okay to go up to that lieutenant colonel and say, X, Y, or Z, or it's okay to go up to this group of captains, that's more likely, and say, "Hey, X, Y, or Z, like, you, like, gentlemen, this is not right."
Well, I think, I think the biggest problem is that NCOs and leaders don't know actually what the standard is. So they come up to a group of people and they say, "Hey, X, Y, and Z is wrong," but they are just basing what they're saying is wrong off of what somebody else told them.
Right.
Or what they heard. Or, I mean, I see it every single day that I'm in the gym and I see somebody come into the gym in PTs before PT hours, but they're still in PTs and they're wearing the wrong headphones. And I'm like, hey man, are you tracking? Like, you can't wear those. And 9 times out of 10, oh no, I had no idea. But again, it goes back to knowing the standard. And then I think it's also the culture within the organization. And that's where I think it starts, to be able to go outside of your organization and make those corrections at the shopette or at the PX or walking down the street or wherever it is. It's, does your organization have a culture where if Private Walsh comes up to Major Bridgeford and says, hey, you've got something wrong on your uniform, or you did something that's not within Army regulation, that Major Bridgeford is going to scream at that soldier and tell him, hey, mind your own business.
And I will, because I'm petty.
Yeah, I'm a major, you're a private, what do you know? And just walk away.
Which is like, well, and I'll say that, because that, because then you go into the extremes, right? And we've all had that, where now you have a courtesy patrol at every PX, and everybody has to now give up a staff sergeant or above to go to the, like, or for their first sergeants now have to take time out of their day to go stand at a PX, and everyone's going to be like, oh, this is so dumb. Can you, like, why do we have to have this? Like, why do you think we have to have this? Like, we went to an extreme, which mm-hmm. I think I was here the first time I was here. We hit that extreme mm-hmm. to where people were at the PX or people were at the gym putting, you know, like there had to be a sergeant major at the gym every day. Why? Not to make sure everybody's in uniform, to make sure everybody's actually doing PT, because people just go into the gym and they hide out because it gets cold here.
Yep.
Which is, you know, wild. And then everybody complains about that, but they never self-reflect on themselves to say, okay, well, how could we have made this better? Or
absolutely.
How could we have like prevented this from happening?
Absolutely.
So then a controversial question here, and I hope it's super controversial, and I hope you are scared a little bit. Whose fault is that? Like, when we look at officers who are they're the standard bearer. They're supposed to be the standard bearer. We also look at NCOs, backbone of the Army, so also supposed to be the enforcers of that standard. Yeah, we have these problems. And if you ask anybody candidly, right, if you ask anybody in front of the right camera or the right, you know, the right people, they're like, oh, no, we're the most professional organization in the world, which holistically, I think we are. We're a fantastic professional organization. But when we start to get to our level of leadership, which is, you know, face-to-face with everyday soldiers, you know, we get to see where the failures are at. So where are the failures at? Do you think it's more on the officer side, who are the standard bearers, or do you think it's on the NCO side, which is standard enforcers?
I don't think it's a controversial question at all. It's the NCO's fault.
It's us. It's, oh, okay. Whew. Just
100% our fault, from Sergeant E5 all the way up to Command Sergeant Major. It's our fault. And every time we walk by these deficiencies, and just like I said, when I go into the gym, I know I'm not the only NCO in the gym.
Right.
Because I know some of those other people. And so I sit there for a little bit, and I'm like, man, not one person is going to say something to this guy about his headphones. And yeah, is our headphones like a big deal? No, in the grand scheme of the world, no, what headphones you're wearing are not a big deal, but it is a standard, and that's what we're supposed to uphold. And even back to your question about, is the military soft? If it is soft, or it's gotten soft, again, I think that it's the NCO's fault because it's gotten soft. We've let it get soft because we're not upholding standards.
Do you think, well, now this is going to sound like I'm just arguing with you, because I'm not, but I don't think it's all on you. Like, I know you're obviously taking stand in the ground on, like, as a Command Sergeant Major, you're looking at it and saying from NCOs. But do you feel like your officers are holding you to the same sort of standard that maybe you saw growing up? Or do you think, or at least not your officers, because your officer's a battalion commander who's, and, you know, then brigade commander, right? So they are probably holding you. They're probably looking at you in whatever meeting you go to and be like, hey, guys, this is where we need help, right? But now, majors and below, do you see that? Like, one, do you even see the standard being upheld? Which, no, I'm not going to lie, when I look at my peers and younger, I don't necessarily see it. And I'm not perfect. I'm not sitting here as, like, you know, the person on a pedestal here. I know I make mistakes. I'm hesitant to do some things, as admitted. Where do you see that being, you know, are they also living to that standard to live by example?
I mean, a perfect example of this was when we were just at the National Training Center. And, well, there's a lot more NCOs than there are officers.
Sure.
I mean, in a company, you got maybe five.
Yeah.
If depending on how many platoon leaders you got, an XO and a company commander, and you've got team leaders, you got squad leaders, you got platoon sergeants, you got all of these other people that can see and hear everything that's going on. And some of them are even specialists that are put into leadership
right.
positions.
Yeah.
And I went out to one of our companies, and they were basically parked in a field in the box. Not truly like a parking lot, but pretty close, right?
Why is everybody mad at us?
Yeah, so...
Why do they care?
They were all just parked out there. No camouflage, no use of terrain, no nothing. Just okay. out there. And okay. it's not like we have small equipment.
That's hard.
There was, I mean, like, bridges out there.
Camouflage is hard.
There was a bridge in a field.
Like, was it out?
No.
Okay.
But they did exercise it, so they did open it to do PMCS, which was great.
so not all bad.
No, not all bad. And so I pulled all the NCOs in, and I said, hey, like, how many of you were here when you pulled in to this area to park? And, like, a bunch of them raised their hand, and I go, and how many of you thought that this was okay? And they kind of laughed, and I was like, why are you laughing? Like, it's not funny. Whose fault is this right now?
Right.
Whose fault is it that this is like this? Is it your company commander? Is it your PLs? Is it your XO? Is it all of them? Or did any of you, because you just laughed and thought it was funny, did any of you say, hey, maybe we shouldn't park here? And of course,
say,
the answer was no.
Oh, yeah, of course not, Sergeant Major.
Yeah, no, of course not. Of course, why would we say anything to benefit our organization or say anything? I mean, and again, is it ultimately the fault of the commander? Sure. Everything's a commander's
right.
program. Everything's the fault of the commander. I understand that. But he has a first sergeant, and he has platoon sergeants, and he has squad leaders and team leaders, and he has all these NCOs that are supposed to be doing the right thing.
Is that was that typical behavior of that company, or do you think it was like a one-off?
They were struggling at the time. And it was specifically NCO engagement. I mean, that was the common thread throughout the rotation for that specific company was NCO engagement. And that's specifically what I told them. I was like, I need more. We need more. Your company commander is running ragged right now because he can't do it all.
Right.
And he's not supposed to be doing it all.
That's fair. That's a fair point. I think that entitlement sounds the right word, but if that empowerment is the direction I want to go. So I think that empowerment that we give them, and I think it takes a lot of, and this is where maybe if I can speak on the behalf of officers everywhere, where we sometimes struggle is like we are so busy because even in garrison it doesn't stop, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we like to make an excuse like, look at my daily thing. There's no white space to do anything, and that's probably true for almost all company commanders. But there's a lot of work that can be done ahead of time to prevent that, because there's companies out there that went out there, not just in First Eng, but that went out there and said, we weren't like that. We did not do that. We did the right things all the time. It's because we were trained to do these things no matter what, parking for 5 minutes or 15 or parking here for the night, because this is what we're going to be doing, doing the right thing. So I think, you know, on the officer side, leaning forward and putting that time in with those NCOs is, I think, a bigger deal than you kind of give it credit for until you're at NTC and you realize, I haven't talked to my first sergeant all day.
Mm-hmm.
I really hope that they're all doing the right things that I think in my head that they should be doing, and then you realize that they're not. And I fell prey to that a ton. I remember the first time I got really yelled at by, I mean, this is like, I was a first lieutenant, I was a platoon leader, and we were doing these like stakes things, like you just went all across Fort Cavazos, and you just did all these like different training things, and one of them was like you had to fix track on a tank. So we finally got to that, and I'm like knee deep into like helping my guys, and we're doing this thing, and of course the team that wasn't doing it, they were just like relaxed out on top of the tank, like just like we've never said to do this ever, right? You just never even think about it. And the battalion commander comes over and pulls me aside, and great man, great human being, and he said, what is that? And I look over and I'm like, no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I have like no answer for it. So I do, yeah. So it's frustrating, but you're right. I think it's like the discipline that those guys have to train in their units. So we talked about a little bit about units and pride in our units, pride in where we're at. Where how do you convince people? Because obviously, I don't know how much recruiting you do. You probably do none to get people to come to Fort Riley. It's just not your job, not your nature. But how do you convince people once they're here that Fort Riley, one ID, this is a great place. Like, this is home. This is a family here. And family is not always, hey, bud, come here. I'm going to make sure you're the happiest person in the world. Family is now I'm going to uphold you to a standard because my family, it's like, what's what we do. So, you know, how do you, you know, what are some of the things you do to help convince soldiers that, you know, to get over this, I don't want to say negative stereotype of Fort Riley?
So I ask the new soldiers that as well. I ask them, and don't lie to me, how many of you were bummed when you got told you were coming to Fort Riley? And, you know, at first, exactly. And at first, you know, they're...
He's still upset.
Yeah, they don't want to come. Or they don't want to tell me that they were bummed that they were coming to Fort Riley. And then I was like, come on, like, I'm not going to be mad. I understand you're in the middle of Kansas. And then I tell them that this is my third time here because right. I was a platoon sergeant here in 1st Engineer Battalion. I was the first sergeant for 41st Clearance Company for a short period of time. I came back. I was the ops sergeant major for 1st Engineer Battalion, the brigade ops sergeant major for 1st Brigade, and then took 1st Engineer Battalion. But it goes back to that senior specialist, and you make it what you want it to be, not what somebody else tells you. There's going to be problems in every single unit.
Right.
I personally feel that every single soldier should at least have to see two duty locations before they have the chance to get out. And it, not anything saying that Fort Riley's bad or anything like that. It could be that your first duty station was, you know, Fort Irwin.
You want to talk about.
Yeah, I don't think that those soldiers are super excited about going to Fort Irwin as well.
Yet most of the people you talk to out there, they're like, yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
I mean, and maybe it's just that one thing that's different at a different duty location. But really making this experience here at Fort Riley your own and not letting somebody else tell you about how crappy it is or their bad experience about how they got screwed and they didn't get to go to air assault school and they're the 10-year specialist.
They never leave their barracks room.
Yeah, they never leave the barracks room. All of the things that they're going to tell you in the barracks after work about how terrible this place is, and you need to make up your own decision and get out of the barracks and see the things that Fort Riley and the community and can offer.
Yeah, which I think, I mean, again, we've been multiple places too. This is our second time back at Fort Riley, and I will put this community up against any other as far as like what the not just like Junction City and Manhattan, but also the internal community here. Like what we try to do for the soldiers and families here, like you actually don't get that anywhere else. And we've been enough places to know.
Absolutely.
Like Fort Riley not only tries hard, but they crush it. And I think you're going to see that coming up this summer. We have a ton of events for soldiers to enjoy as well. So with that,
I think part of that is, and we're dealing with it as we are starting to get ready for Europe, is we can tell our soldiers all of these different things. We have a brawl coming up, and we can tell our soldiers all of the things that are going on around Fort Riley. There are different avenues that spouses can find out and all of these different things. But what I've seen, like part of the biggest issue is there's a breakdown in communication from when Sergeant Major Walsh tells 600 people, hey, these are the things going on, that same message doesn't make it to the spouse. And then the spouse potentially isn't working. Maybe she's new. Maybe she doesn't have a driver's license. Maybe she doesn't have very many friends, whatever the case may be. And one of her sole sources of information on what things are happening around Fort Riley is her spouse.
Right.
And then he doesn't go home and tell her that there's a ball coming up because he doesn't want to go to the ball. But you know who wants to go to the ball?
Yeah.
His spouse.
Yeah.
She's the one that wants to go.
And for everybody out there, balls are way more fun than like you think they're going to be. I know you think you're just going to get in your dress uniform and it's just going to be this stupid, like super ceremony. No, the ball is fun. Like it's fun. It's a great time. Get over yourself if like you think that the ball is going to be dumb. Like it's relatively cheap. Like you find like you if you have yet to see a humanized sergeant major or first sergeant, you are going to see a humanized leader at the ball, and they're remarkable. They're fun. So go.
Absolutely.
That's it. All right, so we did talk about a lot today. So we talked a journey of journeys, a journey of a thousand journeys, if you will, with you today. So I think, one, thank you for that. I think it's really important to understand that, you know, we don't want everybody to go through what you did. We'd rather them find some internal discipline, find the help that they need, so they're not going through dark times to get them through the light. But nonetheless, thanks for sharing your story today. I appreciate it, and we'll have to have you back on time and really get nitty gritty into some of those inter service years that we talked about today.
Yeah, all right, absolutely. Thanks.